Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Tonight on Classic Business, we cut straight to the heart of one of the biggest global economic challenges, the world's infrastructure gap. And we can see it not just in the developing world, but in the developed world as well. A new report from the B20 Finance and Infrastructure Task Force released this week shows that $3 trillion US a year is being spent, but it's still nowhere near enough, especially for emerging markets. And with South Africa leading the G20, the spotlight is squarely on us to help drive real solutions. And joining me is Standard Bank Chief Economist Gulam Balim to unpack the B20 Finance and Infrastructure Task Force's sharp new recommendations. And I believe Sim Tshabalala, the CEO of Standard Bank Group, chairs this particular task force. So Gulam, it's always a pleasure and a privilege to have you on the show, especially at a moment like this when we're holding the G20 presidency. We've got the world spotlight on us. Let's talk about that gap. You know, there's $3 trillion being spent annually on infrastructure, yet we still have this widening global gap. From a macro perspective, how much of this gap is a failure of policy and how much is a failure of coordination?
A good share falls into each bucket, Michael. So there's several areas that we're attempting to address and acknowledge with regard to the report. I think the first, quite simply, is how do we de-risk the financial ecosystem so as to make it more compelling and bankable for infrastructure projects to come to the fore? Second, it is also recognition that perhaps there needs to be clearer policy with regard to priority areas of infrastructure. So, for example, energy, logistics, green infrastructure, technology, the network industries broadly require priority because they're foundational. And then to, you know, your point as well, in referencing idiosyncratic features, Africa too needs to take some responsibility with regard to enhancing the reform agenda. So in terms of fiscal management, anchoring inflation and monetary policy principles, and just the general lurch constructively with regard to the rule of law, means that there is also responsibility on the part of Africans to enhance the attractiveness and absorptive capacity of the continent.
If we look at the recommendations, one of the standout findings in this paper is that 9 out of 10 African infrastructure projects never reach financial close. That's devastating. Anyone who's traveled across Africa will know we have to be able to block that leakage in the pipeline if Africa is to take its next evolutionary step. Why is early stage project preparation still the Achilles heel on the continent?
Michael, numerous reasons. I think quite simply, the ability of many startups to present a compelling case is incredibly difficult. They're not as literate in terms of appeal to international capital markets. There is a dearth of experience in this particular area as well. I think also we're competing with global and mobile capital. For example, artificial intelligence and other modern-day network technologies. Also, large amount of funds continues to seek, let me call it, enhanced returns from crypto, and it's the fashionable area to invest. And then there's also the risk averse, and that will drive funds towards gold, for example. So given the geopolitical fluidity that we're operating in, sometimes it's simply frictions in the supply of capital coming onto the continent, and sometimes it is also that the capacity to present a compelling case is difficult. There's a third area that I would also probably wish to spotlight, and that is that many international investors particularly just simply don't understand African risk. Admittedly, there's a complexity to African risk. There's local nuance to African risk. And in that is an aversion and a hesitation that I guess through education and through increased analysis and the body of work that we as a research body need to do to help narrow that gap between the lack of awareness, the lack of insight, and the capacity to be comfortable and close.
So given that, I mean, what form of intervention? We've got project preparation facilities, for example, or maybe better permitting. What do you think would shift the needle most quickly to ensure that we can improve from that 9 out of 10 infrastructure project stat, you know, never reaching financial close? We really have to make a dent there.
So you're correct. I mean, project preparation has been for a length of time a choke point, and there needs to be assistance by more capable bodies. So, for example, finance institutions shouldn't just be providing lending, but can provide the capacity to aid wannabe startups with regard to budget preparation. I think then also just in terms of the cost of finance, there's been some good progress in recent years with regard to promoting, for example, blended finance and concessional finance. And this de-risking of the finance stack is increasingly coming to the fore. And it speaks to reducing the cost of capital. I think also widening the capital stack. In other words, we tend to think about multilaterals as lending to the continent, syndicated loans, private capital. But there's also philanthropy that I would suspect would have an interest and certainly has got a very, very large wallet that can contribute to the overall funding pool within the continent. But then I think also local industrial policy must seek to create the capacity for local firms to insert them into international value chains. Suddenly that improves the sustainability, the prospects of local entities, and just simply their commercial viability. And of course, you know, perhaps the last point I would mention is just governance and transparency. There needs to be this transparency and increasing governance and just the presentation of financials and business plan coherence that needs to come to the fore. Africa cannot be treated differently to the harsh spotlight that follows international risk and business.
And, you know, very interesting point that you raise, particularly around the cost of capital. And I know your CEO has stressed that on public platforms before, that Africa does now tend to attract elevated risk premia that perhaps don't reflect the true picture on the ground, maybe reflect an Africa of 20 years ago. And the report stresses that emerging markets need lower borrowing costs and we need stronger ratings data. We need more transparent pipelines to channel capital effectively. Are you seeing, given what you've stressed in this report, a willingness from the ratings agencies to engage with this and to reflect on the way they assess African sovereign risk?
So at the minimum, Michael, is to address the rating agencies and not to suggest to them that they lack rigor or that they are inherently inaccurate or even biased, but to suggest that it does appear that in benign times, there is an African risk premium. While it may not be much, and it could be 50 or 80 basis points, it can be still sufficiently punitive. And that African risk premium tends to amplify during increased risk episodes. So if, for example, the global economy is experiencing a downturn or there's recession portending and investors may fear that Africa will be tainted, then you'll see a noticeable rise in African risk premium, for example, as indicated by Eurobond spreads. And I think that that is unambiguous, that is clear. And so this is perhaps in a collegiate way, putting the rating agencies on notice to suggest that we need more transparency, we need more rigor. And the rating agencies have been receptive to this criticism, have been engaging and alive to the enormous role that they play. Initially, there may have been some defensiveness, where some rating agencies would have, in a defensive posture, said they're not the only entity that contributes to the overall framing of risk pricing and risk appetite. But I think they accept that they play a material role, and sometimes they a mechanical role in the way investors with particular mandates will look to the rating agencies' judgments as gospel. And I think we're maturing in that relationship. And henceforth, we'll probably see, as I suggested, greater rigor, greater transparency, and maybe accuracy greater levels of accuracy. And the last point I would just make is, yeah, sometimes I think rating agencies, I would accuse them of being, speculative in their ratings downgrades. In other words, when they foresee an economic downturn, however, they tend to sometimes appear belated in upgrading and want to be evidence-led in before upgrading a particular country in terms of emerging prospects.
And chatting to Hendrik du Toit, the CEO of 91, he said obviously the ratings agencies do a great job, but they do also tend to herd around a particular view or opinion. And from the outside, again, I think it's a constructive critique. One does wonder if there is a degree of groupthink if you are seeing that kind of herding. Anyway, the recommendations of the report really emphasize here that we need better coordination. I think it's obvious we nationally across border between the public and the private actors here. The thing about cooperation is it's easy on paper, very hard in politics. Do you expect the system to evolve towards more maybe platform approaches like the ones we see used in Egypt or Rwanda, or is that too optimistic?
Michael, it isn't optimistic. I think in the sense, if there are so many fissures and broken pieces in terms of Africa stimulating infrastructure spending, it's a good thing because it suggests that we've got a lot to work with. And, broadly speaking, the approach is to say, let's establish a dedicated Africa infrastructure project preparation facility as one intervention. Second, and we've spoken about it, design blended finance vehicles, suited to African risk. Third, we need to draw in pension funds, insurers, sovereign wealth funds. So how can regulations support the steering and ushering of the vast quantities of capital within these financial entities? Fourth, how does domestic policy promote infrastructure investment around industrialization, around energy programs? I think if, for example, as South Africa did, the liberalizing of the energy landscape resulted in a massive amount of private capital flowing, for example, in rooftop solar, but also in independent solar outside of the Eskom, from just a costless regulatory change, even if it required a great deal of political will. So those type of changes, and the last one I'll just mention is just to develop transparency platforms and asset data ecosystem, which is what we refer to it in the paper, where there's greater insight into the data, transactions that are taking place, and lessons to be harnessed from experiential episodes on the continent.
It was so interesting, Ghulam, attending an employee benefit summit in Diani Beach, just south of Mombasa in Kenya, a couple of months ago, and listening to the Kenyan pension funds regulator, Charles Mchira, castigate the local pension fund industry and trustees for being very vanilla in their approach, parking the assets, the pension fund members' monies and savings in government bonds mostly, and not saying, what role do we have to play as institutional capital and our asset consultants to say, let's pool our money together, let's invest in renewable energy projects, for example. We know we desperately need electrification across the East African region. We know we need to build out roads and other infrastructure. They seem to be no regret build-outs, yet there is a kind of safety in herding around government bonds. Just lastly, and I mean, given all of this, you've long argued that institutions and not resources determine growth trajectory. So which are the institutional weaknesses that are most blocking infrastructure progress today? And how do we start fixing them? Where would you start?
So under the broad umbrella of the rule of law, and there's multiple shortcomings, the legal infrastructure needs to be robust so that investors can be comforted that if there is any breach, that it can be judiciously and speedily adjudicated. So that's one, for example. But just generally, apart from, let's say, the judicial system, the overarching capacity to enforce laws, personal security, institutions that facilitate the audit and accuracy of company statements, if there is capital markets, how deep are they? Are they well regulated? And just even a tax authority that is integrist and robust, where companies do not want to come into a country and find that they are subject to discretionary taxation, random approaches from the tax authority, rather than necessarily a predictable set of laws. So overarchingly, the rule of law that promotes predictability and inherently efficiency. And in many respects, Africa is shortcoming in this arena. Just to your question on your experiences in East Africa, I mean, it's a delicate line. And one wants to establish a balance where you cajole savings capital, savings institutions to investing in, say, infrastructure, but at the same time, not ordaining that direction and compelling them to perhaps facilitate white elephants or political pet projects. So there needs to be a credibility mutually in this regard.
Yeah, very important point that. Ghulam, thank you very much. And I think the report says it clearly. The challenge is enormous and the need we know is absolutely urgent. But the opportunity equally is immense. But none of this gets solved without coordination and confidence and credible commitment. And that's where voices like yours are indispensable. Appreciate your insight and time here on Classic Business.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.